I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
The Amiga seemed to be kicking in, and literally one day my son turned round to me and he said, you know, Mum, I feel happy. And I was like, wow, you know, and he was noticeably happy and noticeably calmer. And a lot of family and friends had also made comments to that effect. I'm not saying there was any dramatic, radical changes. Of course, his attention was still impaired, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that wasn't going to go away. But the fact was that changing his diet had resulted in changes in his behavior and mood. And that's where it all began.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Research highlights a crucial link between nutrition, ADHD, and brain health. And there is some evidence, although not fantastic quality evidence, but some nonetheless, that indicates smart food choices for ADHD and brain health disorders and data on supplementation which can influence cognitive function. On the show, we have Dr. Rachel Gao, PhD, who is both a nutrition professional and experienced researcher, plus a parent of a child with ADHD who has the experience of being in the position of not knowing what to do to help their child. ADHD affects 1 in 20 children, 500,000 in the UK, and roughly 1 in every classroom. And there are some incredible well-known figures in business, the arts, and dance who are diagnosed with ADHD, but there is also a darker side to the condition that doesn't get as much airtime, and this is something that we should be mindful of and something that we discuss on the show today. Dr. Rachel is a London-based psychologist specializing in child and adult mental health and has specific expertise in ADHD, autism, depression, anxiety, and related learning and behavior conditions. In addition, Dr. Gao is a registered nutritionist and has a Master's of Science in Psychological Research Methods. She has published approximately 22 peer-reviewed book chapters and scientific papers, and her first book, Smart Foods for ADHD and Mental Health, is being published in February 2021. Her nonprofit is nutritiousminds.org and private clinic is nutritiousmindsconsulting.com. Dr. Gao frequently lectures at London Met University, the University of Surrey, which is where I met her on my master's in nutritional medicine, and also has an honorary role at the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London. She is very well established in the field of both not only research methodology, but also the research itself on looking at nutritional psychiatry. And she's a firm believer in the pragmatic, wider application of food in these kinds of conditions that don't get enough attention at the moment. So on the show today, we talk about Rachel's personal story with her child's development, omega-3 fatty acids. We spend a bit of time talking about that and why they are critical for the brain and its function. We also talk about clinical trials, looking at supplementation, the impact of the gut on serotonin, dopamine, neurogenesis, and brain inflammation, as well as the utility potentially for omega-3 and depression and ADHD. I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast episode. We talk a lot about some studies. I put some links on thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast. So if you are interested in those studies, then do check those out and do check out the nonprofit that Rachel has as well. On to the podcast. How's your lunch?
My lunch was delicious. Thank you ever so much. Yeah, it was really awesome.
I can't take credit for it because it was a Mob Kitchen's recipe. Yeah. I did it. It was the tahini with courgettes and speedy recipe, less than 12 minutes. Very good recipe, I must say, but I can't take credit for it. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You can. Yeah. It was lovely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Very flavoursome.
Appreciate it.
And nourishing.
And nourishing,
and healthy.
Yeah. Well, add pure lentils to it. So I've beefed up the fibre content.
Yeah, it was really great.
Which I'm sure we're going to talk about in a bit. So, Rachel, I thought the way to start would be maybe talk about how, you know, you got started in nutrition itself. We met very briefly at the end of your lecture in my nutrition medicine master's at University of Surrey. I was enamored by your talk. It was brilliant.
Thank you.
So yeah, I'm so grateful for you coming here. But yeah, why don't you introduce us to how you got started?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long story. So do you want the long or the short version?
Oh, we've got time. We've got time.
Yeah. So there are multiple versions of that story. I'll try and keep it as short and succinct as I can. But for me, really, it all started out when I was a young first-time mum, working mum. I worked in property in St. John's Wood on the very famous Abbey Road. I absolutely loved my job, and my son went to a small private school on Abercorn Place around the corner from my work, which was very convenient. And as the kind of weeks and months went by, I started to get complaints from the teachers complaining about low-level disruptive behavior, just things like he wasn't sitting still, he was getting up out of his chair, he was blurting out the answers, not raising his hand, and all of this was causing disruption for the teachers and for the class as a whole. And it went on. And that basically forced me to seek out help and start my own investigations as to what was going on with my son developmentally, because a lot of his behavior was age inappropriate, you know, so the other little boys weren't acting quite as boisterously as him, or, you know, they were able to conform. And when they were reprimanded in the class, they, you know, would comply. Whereas my son would be told not to do something and he'd be very remorseful. But 10 minutes later, he'd be repeating the same behavior and it would drive everyone wild. And he was constantly getting told off, and this was affecting his self-esteem. And obviously it was disrupting my work as well, because oftentimes they would say, you know, come and get him, come and pick him up, and that would be the end of my working day. So it was really, really tough. And I really felt like I was banging my head against a brick wall. It was like everywhere I turned, there wasn't really much help out there. And this is going back, you know, over two decades ago. So it's quite a while ago. But eventually I sought out help from various professionals, from education psychologists to clinical psychologists to child and adolescent psychiatrists. He had 4 years psychotherapy, which did absolutely nothing. Because what we didn't know is that what in fact he did have was a biological condition that affected his brain. Subtle differences in the wiring of his brain, which gave rise to these behavior differences. He was diagnosed by an amazing psychiatrist, Dr. Richard Stoppett, who confirmed he had ADHD. And that really was the catalyst for me to then, you know, move forward with that diagnostic label. Like, what do I do with this diagnostic label? I didn't know anything about it. Oh my goodness, you know, and how can I, you know, seek help? And we again tried everything from methylphenidate, which in the short term helped, but had quite serious side effects for my son personally that which made us stop because he wasn't sleeping and he wasn't eating and his emotions all over the place.
Just for the listener, what is methadone?
So it's like a psychostimulant medication. It's normally the first line of treatment for ADHD and it can be very effective. It can really make all the difference for a lot of parents. But in our case, although he was better able to concentrate and focus and pay attention, his emotions were all over the place. So he'd be like literally crying hysterically to uncontrollable laughter, and he wasn't eating and he wasn't sleeping. And that was an issue because back then he was at boarding school and, staff couldn't go off duty at nighttime until everyone was asleep. And of course he couldn't sleep. He was like wired till like 2 a.m. And then that caused problems because we were faced with another dilemma, which was to remove him from school unless he could successfully take the medication.
And how long after you discovered there was an issue at school till you had a firm diagnosis?
So basically when he was diagnosed, the reason we were forced to actually get the diagnosis made official was because the school he was at had literally said to us, unless he's medicated, he can't come back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we were faced with a huge dilemma.
Oh, wow.
It was medicate or not be educated at that particular establishment. And it was a well-known school who specialized in ADHD and dyslexia, because this was somewhere down the line.
Gotcha.
You know, he's a bit older now. So that's what we did, but medication didn't work and we did have to remove him from that school. And following that, I decided to give up my career and property altogether. In fact, a little before or around the time he was diagnosed, I just knew it would never work. And, we took some time out to reflect. We actually went off to the south of France. I took him out of school a little bit early. It wasn't working out anyway. Yeah. Apologies. And we went off and spent a marvelous 3 months in the south of France. And that I put my thinking cap on. I was like, look, you know, our lives are so disrupted. Like, what are we going to do? I need to start again. I need to reassess, realign. And that's when I decided to go to uni. So I was fortunate that they allowed or permitted me entry under the remit of being a mature student, because I hadn't gone down the conventional academic route. When I left school, I'd gone straight into the property world because I wanted to, you know, basically, you know, buy my own property.
Would have been a really good career, like lucrative career.
It was an amazing career. Yeah. I mean, I bought my first place at 25 and it was great. I met wonderful people from all over the world. I mean, you know, I wasn't just stuck in an office. I was out and about all day. I love that. And I'm a very sociable person. So it was great for me. But I gave it all up and I got into uni and I did a undergraduate degree in a Bachelor of Science in Psychology. And then that led me to a Master of Science in Psychological Research Methods. So mainly kind of statistics, critique of clinical trial, that, you know, trials, that kind of thing. And then that led to a PhD at the Institute of Psychiatry, in fact the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at King's College London. I was there for 4 years. One day, just before I was about to finish my PhD, I got a call from a scientist in America inviting me to come and do a postdoctoral research fellow role in the section of nutritional neuroscience at the Institutes of Health in National Institutes of Health, NIH in Bethesda, Maryland.
What which year was that? Because that seems really before its time. Like now, nutritional psychiatry is this new sexy term, but that's really ahead of the game.
Yeah. So I went there in 2012.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For 4 years till came home in 2016. Yeah.
Epic. That's so cool.
Yeah. So really my experience as a mum with my son, so the personal experience led me to the professional experience. And certainly my son was the driving force behind my change in career and decide to kind of research, you know, this neurodevelopmental difference, because I knew nothing about it and I was struggling. I had nowhere really to turn. And I knew that other parents out there must be going through the same thing. And there must be more than just methylphenidate, surely. You know, what else is out there? What else can help? And by understanding the brain and understanding, you know, which I'm sure we'll come to, the nutritional composition of the brain, you know, and the importance of what we refer to as brain selective nutrients to optimize both the structure and the function of our brain and its cells and its, you know, neuronal membranes. That really enabled me to also help my son. One of the first things I tried with my son when Ritalin didn't work, or methylphenidate, if I'm not allowed to use the trade name.
Everyone calls it the trade names, even okay. Here in the NHS.
Fair enough. Was omega-3 fatty acids. And it was quite by chance. A family friend who'd gone to uni with my brother was working for a nutraceutical company at the time. And she just phoned me up. She heard that I'd really been struggling with my son. She's like, hey, have you heard of omega-3? And I was like, no, what's that? And she said, I'll send you some supplements. Why don't you try them out? And I was a little bit skeptical. I was like, you know, what on earth a little fish oil pill is going to do, whatever. But hey ho, I was desperate. I'll try anything.
Yeah.
And so we took them. We followed the instructions on the box. And after 6 weeks, she called me up and she was like, hey, how's it going? And I was like, well, to be honest, nothing. I can't see any difference at all. You know, there's no noticeable difference. And she was like, look, there's some research that's just come out of the States showing that children and young adults of ADHD have very low levels of omega-3 in their blood. And perhaps if you increase the dose, because you may in fact be trying to correct a nutritional insufficiency and one that takes longer, because we know it takes around 6 weeks to physiologically alter the red blood cell composition of omega-3. So she was like, try increasing the dose to 1 gram plus a day. And I was like, are there any side effects? You know, what's going to happen? She's like, not really. Maybe sometimes they can repeat on you. And sometimes you can get loose stools or something like that. But it should be fine. Just monitor, you know, any changes. And so I was like, okay. So we upped the dose and we carried on. And I also changed his diet around the same time. So I cut out sugar. I cut out processed foods. I started making meals from scratch, which was alien to me because I'd been a very, very busy working mum, you know. And so I went back to basics, got back in the kitchen. You know, I'd give him salmon and he took his supplements. He also took multivitamins.
What were his eating habits prior to the change in diet?
Well, hands up, you know, I'm guilty. You know, it was literally always, you know, food on the go.
Yeah.
You know, and even sometimes on the way home from work, we would eat out because I'd be exhausted, you know, and I'd be like, I don't even want to go home and cook, you know.
My mum, she's an amazing cook.
Yeah.
I grew up with her cooking home cooked meals all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was a working mum. She was working in the city.
Yeah.
You know, and we had grab and go meals all the time. And especially back in the day, you know, it was the fashionable thing to do. And it wasn't seen as unhealthy or whatever. It was just like, why wouldn't you do that? Because it is time saving and it, you know, you're feeding your kids. And they're happy and they love it. So why not? So don't feel guilty.
It was the era of the microwave meal.
Totally,
yuck.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's not to say we did that all the time, but that certainly took place. And I, you know, lunch boxes were, you know, a packet of crisps, a chocolate mini roll, you know, a ham or cheese sandwich or something like that. Absolutely gross. You know, I couldn't think of anything worse now. But so we went back to basics, got back in the kitchen. I educated myself on, you know, different types of foods and the omega seemed to be kicking in. And literally one day my son turned around to me and he said, you know, mom, I feel happy. And I was like, wow, you know, and he was noticeably happy and noticeably calmer. And a lot of family and friends had also made comments to that effect. I'm not saying there was any dramatic radical changes. Of course, his attention was still impaired, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that wasn't going to go away. But the fact was that changing his diet had resulted in changes in his behavior and mood. And that's where it all began.
It's such a powerful story. And I think like so many people will resonate with that as well. Not only with, you know, parents who have gone through a similar journey, but also parents who don't know where to start as well. Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, what you were doing at the start mirrors a lot, you know, with my own personal story and with a lot of other people's stories of you're just trying little experiments here and there because there wasn't that much information. There wasn't that much general knowledge. The internet wasn't rife with both misinformation, but also good quality information as well. So I think, you know, that is it. I mean, it really does resonate a lot. And I think it's really honest as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I would go to my GP and talk about my child's behavior, the question, you know, what does he eat or what do you feed him was, you know, never arose. And why would it? Because as we know, you know, the BBC very bravely published an article a couple of years ago saying that medical students are only getting around 2 hours training on nutrition. And I think the UK as a whole are a little bit, although we're getting much better, there've been huge, you know, shifts in the ways that people approach food now. But food to me really is medicine, and food doesn't just have an effect on our physical health. Because when we speak about food, it's often dressed from the neck down in terms of its preventative role in disease, you know, diseases such as the premature development of cancer or type 2 diabetes or obesity or stroke or cardiovascular disease, you know, that's what's more commonly known. But when we talk about the role of food to the brain, then that's just such a murky, you know, we're treading in murky waters because people are like, hey, what really, what you eat affects your brain? Who'd have thought?
Yeah.
But it does at molecular and cellular levels. And for example, when my son said to me, I feel happy, Mum, now I know sort of 14 years down the line why he was able to communicate that to me, because of the mechanistic action of omega-3 highly unsaturated fatty acids in the regulation of dopamine and both the dopaminergic and serotonergic systems in our brain rely on omega-3 fats. And, you know, now I understand the nutritional composition of the brain, you know, that it's the fattest organ in our body, that it comprises, well, at least 65% of the dry weight of the adult brain, and retina is made up of these specialized, complex, unique fats called lipids. I didn't know that. And that around 20 to 25% of our brain is made up of docosahexaenoic acid, or DHA. So, yeah, I mean, it's estimated we have, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but in the region of about 100 billion neurons in our brain. And each of those neurons is coated in a myelin sheath, which is made up of DHA. And what that does is it speeds up cell signaling across the brain's networks to make faster and more efficient communication. And people like Professor John Stein, who's a neuroscientist, brother of celebrity seafood chef Rick Stein, he specializes in dyslexia, and in particular, I won't go into any details, but magno and parvula cells in the role of dyslexia. And some of his work has shown that insufficient amounts of omega-3 alters these cells. And an omega-3 insufficiency can slow down cell signaling by up to around 30%. So if you think about that in a translational sense, and you think about children in a class and a teacher's asking a question, and then you have one child who has hypothetically adequate omega-3, who's able to, you know, fully compute the answer, understand the question, you know, hand up, ready to deliver the answer, versus someone who's still trying to figure out what the question was. I mean, that's potentially the difference. That 30% difference, up to 30% difference. Yeah,
I mean, it's incredible when you think about it like that. And I like the, you know, the approach of, you know, the translation of that into what actually plays out in a classroom with someone who's light years ahead. And I think, you know, who knows what the omega-3 levels are like across the board when it comes to children?
Well, we know. Yeah, the research has been done. So an amazing lady and good friend of mine, Dr. Alex Richardson, at the University of Oxford, has been doing these clinical trials in children who are underachieving in mainstream schools.
Okay.
And she did a study called the DOLAB study, where she measured the omega-3 index of UK school children. And she found a mean, which means average, you know, just the average score of around 2.4. So I'm going to just take you through the index. So the suboptimal levels are between 0 and 4%. Then you have the intermediate range, which is between 4 to 8%. And then you have the optimal range between 8 to 12%. Now, this omega-3 index was developed by someone called Clemens von Sharkey, and it's a reliable and robust predictor of the risk of the development of cardiovascular disease. But increasingly, over the last decade, researchers in the field of nutritional psychiatry have been looking at this index in relation to the risk of psychiatric disease, because we know that if you eat a diet lacking in omega-3 and rich in omega-6, for example, it can switch on inflammatory markers in your brain. And there is this kind of general consensus that underlying a lot of psychiatric illness is inflammation in the brain, in the body and brain. So inflammation can be a trigger and is implicated in psychiatric illness. So looking at the omega-3 indexes, in terms of psychiatric help, it's not conclusive by any means. It's been looked at as a marker. So let's have a look and see how this correlates. And of course, correlation does not imply causation ever. But increasingly, a lot of clinical trial research is showing in ADHD, omega-3 indexes of 4 or below. And in my clinical trial at the NIH, our adults with ADHD, if I remember correctly, was just over 4. So it's like 4.1. So still really within suboptimal range. But the great news is we can correct that.
Yeah.
You know, we can incorporate fish into our diet, and we can eat, as the government recommends, at least, you know, 2 portions of oily fish per week. You know, salmon, wild Alaskan salmon, trout, you know, lots of seafood. And we can correct that, and we can test for our omega-3 index. And if children have ADHD, like my son did, and they don't eat fish, because initially he really didn't like fish, then supplements are a good way to start, you know, by making sure they get their omegas.
The index that was used in the DOLAB study, demonstrating that mean, which is super shocking.
Yeah, super shocking.
Yeah, that's really disconcerting, actually.
It's worrying that children don't like to eat fish.
No. Yeah.
How can we convince them?
Yeah. I'm working on it.
Yeah, you've got to.
But has a similar study been done across psychiatric units, perhaps? Maybe inpatient units or anything like that?
No, and that's a shame. At one stage, I was, in fact, I did design a clinical trial, but here in the UK, it's so hard to get funding, and especially for nutritional studies, because unfortunately, as we discussed earlier, you know, it's the disease model of medical kind of management in terms of symptoms. And it's like, oftentimes pharmaceuticals get the funding, whereas, you know, nutritional research doesn't. And that's a big shame. And also it is problematic because oftentimes nutrients work in synergy. They don't work in isolation. So for example, if you did decide to do a clinical trial supplementing children with like a 1 gram fish oil capsule, for example, it's not necessarily going to work. And there are many, many reasons for that. One, because most don't test prior to supplementation. So they don't look at the omega-3 index. You know, like what happened with my son, you know, it didn't work in the first 6 weeks. And that's probably because he was insufficient. So if one, you might have to correct an insufficiency with a larger dose or a longer duration of dose. Secondly, the type of formula is really important because there are so many different types of omega-3 fatty acids, and people often get these confused. They're like 3, 6, and 9 or 7, or what do they all mean? You know, just grab, you know, anything in Holland and Barrett, you know, it says omega-3, that'll do. And it's not like that at all. And our neuroscientific research has shown that really the two key highly unsaturated fatty acids that the brain needs are eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and as I mentioned earlier, DHA. And these are really critical for the growth and formation of our neurons, you know, process referred to as neurogenesis, and also for so many other significant biological functions throughout the central nervous system, you know, not only in governing our mood, but there's a wealth of experimental laboratory literature showing that depleting, for example, lab rats of omega-3 results in a 40 to 60% depletion in dopamine in the frontal cortex and nucleus accumbens. And I think, and, you know, that's been replicated time and time and time and time again. You know, the research is there showing, and in particular, a lot of this work has been done by Hee-Yong Kim at the NIH. And she's shown that if you take hippocampal neurons and you put them in a cell culture and you deprive them of omega-3, that results in something called neurite outgrowth. So significantly inhibited neurite outgrowth, which just means the dendrites on the neurons are just not in that nice, healthy tree-like pattern that they should be in order to make the connections in the brain to help with communication. And when you put the omega-3 back into the cell-cultured hippocampal neurons, it restores that neurite outgrowth. So we know that we can modulate our brains, which is a really exciting concept. We're not necessarily stuck with the brains that we have, and we can change them to optimize in terms of function at molecular and cellular levels.
Yeah, I mean, that for me, I think, and hopefully for the listeners as well, will be really comforting to know that there are lots of things that we can do at a later age to improve the function of our brains. One thing, and to essentially reemphasize your point of not conflating the association with causation.
Yes, of course.
But with the Dolab study that demonstrated that association, apart from the few studies that you've mentioned about, you know, the impact on low omega-3 levels and processing speed, or the lab rat studies, has there been any empirical evidence about how we can replace and improve that index of omega-3 with improved outcomes?
Yeah, so absolutely. So just to go back to the Dolab study, first of all, they found that that actually was the omega-3 index score collectively. Then they correlated it to different kind of literacy outcomes. But the same lady, Dr. Richardson, has also done clinical trials. There was the Oxford Durham trial some years ago, which was kind of a bit of a landmark study here in the UK, where she supplemented underachieving school children who also had symptoms of developmental coordination disorder, also known as DCD, or dyspraxia. And it was a 6-month crossover study, randomized, you know, so half the children had a placebo for the first 3 months, and then half had omega-3 supplements. And then the placebo group was crossed over to the active omega-3 supplementation group for the duration of the study. And then it's 3 months, she found significant improvements in the children taking the omega-3 supplements in literacy, particularly in reading and spelling. The gains were quite significant between 3 and 6 months. And then this continued towards the end of the trial. And then in addition to that, there was also improvement on all the Connors scales in terms of their ADHD symptoms as well. So in terms of their behavioral profiles were improved as well. And there have been many, many studies replicating this as well that has resulted in several meta-analyses and systematic reviews of the literature. And in relation to omega-3, the strongest effects have been found for ADHD and clinical depression in terms of reducing symptoms. It's a small to modest effect size. And I personally have looked at those meta-analyses as well. And in some instances, they've included trials that supplemented with kind of, in my mind, quite dubious formulas. So I think we've still got room for improvement. But if the clinical literature, I think there's like maybe even 5 meta-analyses now showing this effect size for omega-3. So we can't dismiss the science. It might be small, but there are other, you know, SSRI antidepressant medication with similar effect size, yet they're being prescribed to people with depression. But you know, I'd like us to be at a place where when someone presents themselves with some type of mental health struggle, whether it's depression or anxiety or whatever, ADHD, that they are simultaneously referred to a dietitian or nutritionist for a full blood screening of their nutrient levels, because we know, you know, deficits in vitamin D, in B vitamins, in omega-3 fats, in all sorts of trace elements can have or play a role in these conditions. So correcting any insufficiencies, looking at the gut health, what's going on there? It's our second brain.
Yeah, yeah.
Serotonin is made in the gut. And serotonin and dopamine, I should just clarify, like serotonin is the hormone neurotransmitter that we need for feelings of well-being and happiness, whereas dopamine is associated with reward and pleasure, and hence why it can become addictive, because, you know, humans are kind of hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain, and oftentimes they'll do anything to get that hit of dopamine, whether, and that's why they can, you know, become addicted to harmful substances like alcohol or nicotine or marijuana, cocaine, even social media, you know, sex, whatever, you know, food's number one, junk food, because it releases dopamine and they're like, hey, this feels good, I want some more, you know.
One of the things I want to come back to is the fact that so you had this personal experience with your son, you saw some impact with diet and supplementation. And then you went and did quite an important part of your journey, which is learning how to interpret studies and actually look at the statistics, which is something that you've clearly demonstrated in this short time we've been speaking and during your lecture as well. That gave you the tools to come at these studies with a rigorous scientific approach as well. Were there any elements of your training during that time which kind of made you a bit disheartened about nutrition as a science in general? This is more of a general question, because I think to the point about your that you were just making about meta-analyses and how the number of them is quite low, the heterogeneity is likely to be high, we don't use the same omega-3 doses in the studies, it's really frustrating when they use really low doses, and it's something we see time and time again in nutrition. How has that changed, if anything, at all over your career, and what do you see the way forward?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and thanks for raising it, because it's an important one. It is disheartening that nutrition isn't taken as seriously as it should be in my mind, and especially in mental health, which is my personal area of expertise. Hence why I was very keen to take up this postdoc at the NIH, because for those that don't know, the National Institutes of Health is one of the largest and arguably leading biomedical research agencies in the world. They engage in what's called high-risk, novel, cutting-edge research, and ultimately they save lives. And the wonderful thing about conducting any research at the NIH is that you get to design your own trial, and that's super exciting for someone like me. And also because at King's College, I'd worked with children and adolescents with ADHD and compared them to healthy controls in terms of their brain activity using electrophysiological recordings of brain activity. In other words, EEG, where they wear this like swimming cap with all these electrodes, and we look at some of their cognitive and emotional responses. And I looked at that in relation to omega-3. So going to the NIH suddenly meant that I could now transition from children and teenagers into adults. And that was something I really wanted to do. And this time I went a step further in terms of neuroimaging, and I looked at what's known as functional and structural MRI. So we wanted to conduct this neuroimaging trial, a supplementation trial, giving adults of ADHD omega-3, and literally upping the dose to FDA, within FDA safe levels, which is 3 grams, and seeing what effects it had in brain activity pre and post supplementation. It was extremely difficult to recruit adults of ADHD in Washington, DC, because many of them were all on a cocktail of prescription medication. And in order to use MRI, it wouldn't be ethical or safe necessarily to ask them to withdraw. And that was really tough because oftentimes adults with ADHD, you know, the core symptoms are kind of just disorganization and procrastination. They're highly distractible. They can suffer with interpersonal relationships. They often are very creative, have all these projects going on, but trouble with follow through, and they tend to self-medicate. And as a result, they have all these overlapping features of depression, anxiety, maybe OCD, whatever. So what happens then is when they're treated medically, they're given, you know, for example, an antidepressant plus something for their anxiety. So they might be on Zoloft, fluoxetine, Lexapro, like you name it. And it's very hard to do neuroimaging research when you're on so many different medications. So we really struggled to get the numbers. So the trial did lack statistical power, but it did provide really interesting insights and resulted in significant, some small but significant differences in brain activation in those taking the omega-3 where there were no changes in the placebo. And in particular, we found some effects in the anterior cingulate cortex and the insula and areas of the brain associated mainly with attention and emotion networks. So that was really interesting. We're about to publish this. And I'm hoping and praying that it can be a stepping stone for other neuroscientists to think, let me explore this further. You know, we were very fortunate to have the funding in order to conduct the clinical trial. And I do recommend other postdocs consider, you know, leaving, you know, their comfort zone and maybe going abroad, you know, and seeing what else is out there, seeing what opportunities are out there, because that opportunity would never have been granted to me had I stayed in the UK. Sadly to say that, but to answer your original question, nutritional research and nutritional psychiatry is not getting the funding it deserves. I mean, it's very hard to do a randomized placebo controlled trial with food. I mean, what is a placebo for a salmon? I don't know. But then it's like, you know, we have to be a little bit rational sometimes, because the same way you wouldn't do a randomized placebo controlled trial of a parachute, would you? Because no. I wouldn't want the placebo parachute. You know, when it comes to nutrition, they don't work in isolation anyway. They all act in synergy with each other. So when you eat a piece of fish, for example, you don't just get the omega-3s you need for your brain to function, but you also get all the trace elements. So you get, you know, iron, iodine, magnesium, selenium, you know, the B vitamins, and these all work together to make our brain work as it should. Yeah,
this is what I talk about so much on the pod. You know, it's the orchestra of different ingredients that you find within a whole food that have the demonstrable effect. It's not just the isolated, you know, element, whether it be a phytonutrient, a fat, or, you know, a micronutrient like vitamin or mineral. So, and this is the unfortunate issue with doing research on these items, because they're just so complicated themselves. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because going back to your original point about how perhaps we should approach psychiatry in its instance should be, okay, first let's isolate something that's cost effective to treat by assessing and screening for nutritional deficits that we know are rife, especially given the Dolab study looking at kids, for example, it's just one point. And let's try and correct that prior to investing a lot of money and a lot of energy and quite frankly potential for adverse side effects with pharmaceuticals. It's hard to make that point in our current environment where, as a general practitioner, you know, we have 8 minutes and we're not nutritionally trained, and we don't have the, you know, the capacity or the tools to assess omega-3 status in our in our patients that come see us.
It's really tough, I know.
Yeah.
And a lot of this work is private, which is really sad in a sense, because everyone deserves to have access, you know, to this knowledge, information, and any potential interventions as well. You know, because as a parent, I really struggled. And that's why in 2017, I set up a nonprofit called Nutritious Minds, which the aim was, you know, to cover the cost of diagnostic services to parents, you know, low-income parents who couldn't even afford to get their child privately diagnosed and who weren't able to access CAMHS because the waiting list was over a year. Meanwhile, the child is at risk of educational failure and permanent exclusion. So it's like, what do we do with these? How can we bridge this gap? Because a lot of parents would come to me and they'd be waiting a year plus for their child to be diagnosed with autism. So I thought Nutritious Minds, you know, which it has been successfully able to help parents on a number of levels, and it's resulted in several diagnoses, and I'm hoping to grow that in the future so that we can go into schools and teach children about the importance of nutrition and what their brain is made of, because that's another big gap we have as well, you know. And it's my favorite question to ask to children when I go into schools. Like, I'm like, hey, what's your brain made of? And everyone looks at me really strangely, but no one really gives me the answer. And I think it's really important because, you know, kids are taught about the body and, you know, the skeleton and, you know, how we need air so that our lungs can breathe and that our heart pumps blood around the body that keeps us alive. But, you know, they're not taught anything about the inner workings of the human brain. Mm. And, you know, I'd hazard a guess that the average 12-year-old wouldn't even know what the functional location of the cerebellum was, for example, you know. So we need to educate people about the brain. I think that's really important.
Definitely. I think there's so much there as well, particularly in a post-pandemic world where mental health is becoming a lot more sort of prominent. I mean, I and my A&E colleagues are quite worried about this tidal wave of mental health issues that's going to land on the doors of not just primary and secondary care, but A&E for sure. And we're already seeing that now. So it's almost like we need to have a strategy where we can engage in self-help, but also responsibly treat where needed with the harder interventions that we already have. I wanted to go back to your experience with NIH, you did your postdoctorate, which is incredible. We've talked a lot about omega-3 as well, I think, which is great. And the foundation of healthy foods, minimizing sugar, the gut microbiota, which you mentioned as being the sort of powerhouse of this factory of a number of different neurotransmitters, serotonin being one of the largest ones, something that can have both direct and indirect impacts on the brain. When did you first start learning about the impact of the microbiota, and what kind of strategies do we have in terms of improving that population for the purposes of perhaps even ameliorating or even treating ADHD and other developmental disorders?
So I guess it was probably around a decade ago I started learning about the gut, and, you know, the gut is commonly referred to now as the second brain, and most people have heard of the gut-brain axis as a terminology. But yeah, understanding what that means is something else. And, you know, our gut is an ecosystem of healthy and unhealthy bacteria, to put it simply. And some time ago, there was a discovery of the vagus nerve, and then we realized that serotonin wasn't being made in the brain predominantly as we thought, and it was actually being made in the gut, and then it was being transported via the vagus nerve, bypassing the blood-brain barrier directly into the brain. And this was like, wow, you know, the whole field of nutritional psychiatry, among others, were like, what is going on? This is so exciting. And it led to pockets of research, you know, out in California, like UC Davis, and a whole bunch of researchers in Cork, in Ireland, who are really kind of pioneers in this field. And we're finding out so much more. In fact, I've written a whole chapter on this in my book in relation to children with autism and ADHD, because what I started finding in my private practice was 100% of the children that came to me with diagnostic labels of anxiety, ADHD, autism, all presented with a range of food intolerances and food allergies. And oftentimes the main culprits were, you know, gluten, wheat, and dairy. So it's like, what's going on here? And then in the same breath, their parents would be like, oh, they're such picky eaters, you know, they're such problematic, you know, eaters, and meal times are a nightmare and I don't know what to do. And all they want to eat is the, what I call the white or beige food. So they want white rice, white potatoes, you know, white bread, or they want, you know, beige foods like chicken nuggets, and they don't want anything touching, and it all has to be separate, and sometimes it has to be in separate bowls. And so, you know, these parents were like crying out for help. And so one of my recommendations is to always investigate. You need to go beyond behavioral symptoms. You need to look at blood. You need to have stool tests, and especially in terms of gut microbiota, because we know, and increasing research has shown, that children with ADHD and ASD have these problematic eating behaviors, and simultaneously present with these food intolerances and food allergies. And it's almost like they're providing their gut bacteria with the fodder for them to, you know, multiply and grow. And then what happens is, when the unhealthy bacteria outweigh the healthy bacteria, you can end up with something called leaky gut syndrome, which again has all sorts of implications for a child's behavior and mood. And we know that the health of the gut is critical for all sorts, a wide range of complex functions, including even sleep, you know. And that an unhealthy gut results in, you know, behavior disturbances, emotional meltdowns, irritability, anxiety, and so much more. So improving the health of the gut, which you can do quite simply with, you know, pre and probiotics, and also avoiding white refined sugar and processed foods, and by feeding your child nourishing bone broths, which are rich in collagen, which can help repair the lining of the intestine as well. Because when you have leaky gut syndrome, your body is almost impossible to retain any nutrients that you're putting in your body. And so in order to stop that from happening, you have to repair your gut first. And also, obviously, it increases the ability to make serotonin, which is very important for happiness. So, yeah.
Mm. It's fascinating that, you know, the number of investigations that we have available to us could provide at least some direction for people. Is there a foundation prior to having the need for investigations that you think most people would benefit from? So, I mean, first thing is you're trying to address the beige diet. And just from anecdote, I get told that all the time by parents of ADHD kids and autistic children as well. They are picky eaters. They won't eat. I remember vividly, actually, I was in A&E in the pediatric department in a Barnet hospital I was working at the time. And the kid came in for something different, 6-year-old. But the father, poor father, he literally had to keep on feeding this child pizza to stop him from going up the walls and stuff. And that was, he was like, it's the only thing he will eat. It's just this pizza, no vegetables on it, not even the tomato sauce, just like the base. That's literally all he would eat. And so this is something
It's a vicious cycle.
It really is.
What they're doing is it kind of pacifies them momentarily, which is only going to be a transient experience, because then it's putting all that junk back into the gut, which is then going to create the mood disturbance. And then they're pacified again with the junk food. And then we go round and round. It's almost like the cycle of addiction, which is, you know, binge, withdrawal, repeat, binge, withdrawal, repeat. It's the same with foods. You know, this is what people are doing. We can become addicted to certain foods. And the work of Professor Robert Lustig has shown, you know, and provided evidence to support the notion that sugar is addictive, because it activates the same reward circuitry in the brain as some, you know, class A drugs. So, you know, junk foods and processed foods, and, you know, it's no secret that some of these food giants have recruited some of the top scientists that have put together this, you know, very clever chemical concoction of chemicals that keep us coming back for more. It's very clever. Like, I always say to the children I work with, I'm like, hey, take that Dorito, dip it in water, now put it in your mouth. What does it taste like? And yes, they spit it right back out because it tastes of cardboard. It tastes disgusting because you've washed the chemicals off. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
It's really interesting, actually, because I remember I was listening to a lecture during my master's program, and they were talking about how, I think it's the Cheeto is like the perfect food when it comes to just maintaining
the right combination of salt, sugar, and savory. That's what it is.
And the texture
you
as well.
You could coat it in dog poop. You're like, seriously, and people would eat it, go, this is so nice.
Yeah, it's so interesting because it kind of melts away and it gives you the thought process of you haven't eaten anything.
Yeah.
And it's really like a brain trickery almost. It's fascinating.
But all of those foods, you know, literally the habitual consumption of junk processed refined foods, you know, do increase risk for metabolic syndrome. I mean, you know all about that as a medical doctor, and all sorts of complications. And, you know, the World Health Organization say by and large, most of the premature development of these non-communicable diseases such as stroke, obesity, type 2 diabetes can be prevented via the diet. It's that simple.
But the question I think I get all the time from parents is, all right, that's fine. I know that.
Yes.
I'm educated. I've read all the books. Yeah. Where do I start? This kid is going up the walls and, you know, it's breaking up my relationship. It's breaking up my relationship with my other children. It's disrupt to other kids. You know, I feel like a bad parent. Like, how do you even get started?
And then the parent becomes depressed.
100%.
You know, and anxious and then start self-medicating with alcohol, you know, like at 4 o'clock, as soon as they've done the school run. Oh my God, where's the wine? Like, you know, I mean, that is so, so common. Absolutely.
Well, what's the strategy? What are the strategies?
So what do we do about it? So because I've lived that experience, I decided to write a book all about it. So I have this wonderful book coming out in February the 18th next year. I hope you won't mind me giving it a bit of a plug, but it's Smart Foods for ADHD and Brain Health, and it's being published by Jessica Kingsley Publishers. And it literally is a guide for parents. It kind of takes them by the hand, because I wish someone had taken me by the hand all those years ago. And some people did, you know, there were a lot of people that did help, and I'm forever grateful. But if I had had a manual, like, or a book that I could just go, oh yeah, I totally get that. And, you know, within the book are recipes, how to change your diet, nutrition plans, like, you know, teaches you all about the brain, the neuroanatomy of the brain, all the clinical research out there. And it literally is kind of my give back, you know, because it's like, what's the point of me accumulating 14 years worth of knowledge if I can't give it back? That would be an utter disservice and waste of my time. And for me, advocacy is so, so important. It's not about what you know, it's about spreading that message and helping other parents in the process, and letting them feel that they're not alone. You know, special children are given to special parents. Like, literally, I subscribe to that, because having my son transformed my life, and, you know, I wouldn't be doing what I do now without him. So literally, yeah. And as I said to you earlier, his name means gift from God. And I truly, you know, subscribe to that. Like, he's changed my life, and now I'm helping to do, you know, play a small role in helping other parents know they're not alone, and give them some knowledge which helped me, in the hope that together we can create change.
One of the things that I tell parents is, well, first of all, try and connect them with a community of other parents that can reason with them, to understand them, because it's very hard for me as someone who doesn't have a kid to try and just say, well, just do this, and then, you know, or this is what you need to do because their gut is ravaged, etc. So my strategy is obviously just to try one thing at a time and to continue to come back to different foods, because, as you know, and as a lot of parents will know, your taste buds will evolve during that infancy period. And so just because they don't like something now doesn't mean they won't like it at some point in the future. But it's that perseverance. It's so hard to conjure, isn't it?
Juicing is one of my main recommendations. If you can juice, because then that's also an opportune moment to slip to slip and hide supplements, you know, that are beneficial. And, you know, find out what fruits and vegetables your child does like and make a blended juice. You know, it should be a 60 to 40% ratio in terms of vegetables and fruit. But even if they just like berries, wonderful. You know, they're full of antioxidants and polyphenols and, get all those blueberries and raspberries and strawberries blended and then, you know, sneak some spinach in. They're not going to notice, or some beetroot or carrot, you know. So there are clever ways. And I do discuss all of this in my book, but you touched on something earlier and it's really important, having a community, you know, so you don't feel alone and not supported. And that's critical. I do a lot of outreach community events for anyone who has any experience of any neurodevelopmental difference or mental health condition. We did have one booked for October called MEND, which is Men's Exercise and Nutrition Development. But unfortunately, due to the current climate, we're going to have to postpone it until next year. But yeah, Nutritious Minds, you know, does a range of kind of outreach work in advocating for nutrition and exercise because they both work together. You know, really, they work in synergy to optimize brain function. So you should always try and at least exercise as well as having the nutrition. And it helped my son a lot. You know, he did athletics, boxing, like gymnastics, trampolining, you name it. Like we were always active. That was the only way to kind of, you know, get him to sleep at night.
Absolutely.
Wear him out.
Yeah. With some of the things that we discussed, with food and sugar, addictive behaviors, leaky gut syndrome, or intestinal hyperplasia, as it's described in the academic literature, these sorts of topics attract a lot of controversy within the dietetic and nutrition world. Yeah. What kind of sort of kickbacks have you had, if any, against some of your colleagues along the way, and why isn't there sort of uniform thinking on this, and where does that controversy lie?
I think it's the seriousness of it, if you like. Are we taking this seriously? And if not, why not? And I think it stems from a lack of understanding and knowledge, literally. Because when I go into, you know, various sort of academic institutions or even schools or even coffee mornings, you know, to speak to parents, like once I finish my talk, you know, everyone's like, wow, this is so interesting. Like, I wish I'd known this. And I had no idea the brain was made of fat. And, you know, so people are hungry for this knowledge. And I think it's literally just, if we can share, make knowledge more accessible and share it, and not just within our little pockets of academia, or, you know, we need to get out onto social media or have our websites and literally just spread the message, because a lot of this research, you know, it gets published and then it's on PubMed and, you know, the clinical database of all the published research all over the world. But a parent's not going to know about PubMed. How do you find PubMed? You know, there are kickbacks from all sorts of people. I mean, like I told you earlier, when my son turned 18 and he'd had chronic ADHD all his life, and I took him to an NHS psychiatrist and I was like, look, can you assess him for adult ADHD? Because in 65% of all cases, you know, child ADHD persists into adulthood. And he literally closed the door and was like, there's no such thing. Adult ADHD doesn't exist. You know, go away, effectively. So it's really important. And even to this day, ADHD has negative connotations. Like, people think it's some funny made up label for naughty schoolboys. But I've actually done the history. Like, I've dedicated like half a chapter of in my book, because I wanted to show that there have been various versions of what we now know as ADHD that date back right back to Sir Alexander Crichton in 1854 and his book on attention and its diseases. And then again in 1902, you know, England's first professor of childhood medicine, Dr. George Still, you know, again cites it. And then sometime later, and we, you know, it's called all sorts of different things, but there are, you know, this can be traced back in the Lancet. You know, it's not some invention of the pharmaceutical industry, it's genetic predominantly, but there are many environmental components. And it's really critical that we, you know, I understand that being skeptical is important, but when you're trying to educate someone about the importance of, you know, a healthy diet and how it may improve mental health, To have sort of doors shut on that message is really disheartening. And we know that people following a Mediterranean diet, it increases longevity. These people live longer. Yeah. They're less likely to have a heart attack and they're less likely to be depressed. But hey, what do I know, you know? Yeah. So it is tough. It really is tough. I mean, you know, you're pushing fruit and vegetables and you can get you into trouble. It's like, seriously.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting because, like, you know, the pushback that I personally had is you give people false hope. Yeah. You know, they'll try these things and they'll enter into a vicious cycle of shame, the fact that they can't achieve that or they can't afford it. Yes. Or, you know, there are a whole bunch of other reasons. I completely get that. Yeah. I mean, working in the NHS in any area in inner city London, you're going to see a full spectrum of people from different backgrounds, both educationally and financially.
Yeah.
So I totally get that. But I think we need to be a bit more aspirational in the choices that we give people and actually give them the opportunity to do that. Because I think any parent, if they had the capacity to, in the same way you did, you gave up a lucrative career to follow something has become your passion, but essentially
it's academic career.
Yeah.
I've never been so poor, seriously. You don't go into science for the money because you're never going to get it. You know, at the end of the day, it's like living a student life for the rest of your life. Yeah, it's tough.
So the skeptics of, you know, what you might be suggesting in terms of, you know, improve your gut health, improve fruit and vegetable, get more diversity in hydration. Yes, use some supplementation as there is some evidence based on it. So, you know, the pushback I feel comes from that angle. But I don't know. I can kind of reason with both sides, but I'm certainly more of the side of, well, give people the choice and the information and be pragmatic about it. It's not you're promising anything.
Transferring the knowledge is important, and then it's up to the individual what they want to do with that knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You know, it's like your GP saying, you need to give up smoking or you need to cut back on alcohol. It's like people will ultimately do what serves them. But I think at least if you have the knowledge, then, and if you're suffering, and most people don't want to live in pain, and if they are suffering, and say pharmaceuticals haven't worked for them, potentially, then what do you do with those children? Because that's, you know, in terms of what we spoke about earlier, the first line of treatment is Ritalin or something like that, you know, a psychostimulant. But, you know, there is, basically, if you look at the statistics, there are 2/3 that will respond to that medication, but there are 1/3 that won't. They'll have to discontinue either because the side effects are too severe or they're non-responders. So not everyone is going to respond positively. So my son was one of the non-responders. We did try it. You know, as a parent, you'll try anything. You want it to work, you know. But if it doesn't work, what do you do? And for me, thankfully, that whole nutritional kind of exercise, you know, holistic door and route opened up to me. And I think that people are wanting alternatives now, or they're wanting additional. So I think in many cases we have to move beyond the prescription pad if we can. Of course, some medication is critical and life-saving, and it, you know, there's no other options, and you know, but I'm talking to people who are not, you know, being who basically may have just have mild depression, or they may have ADHD or something like that, and they want to see what else is available to them. And I think it's important that we share that that leading a healthy lifestyle and having a kind of personalized, integrative approach to healing is important for me. So I think it's never just one thing, you know, it's always a combination of many things together that can help improve a mental health condition, for example. So whether that's mindfulness, meditation, with, you know, some sort of talking therapy, with nutrition, with some type of exercise, and if a medication helps as well, then yes, the holistic approach. It's just my personal approach is non-pharmacological, and that's my personal choice.
Totally.
Mild mental health conditions.
With adult ADHD in particular, you touched on it before, but I wanted to to hammer the point about the associations between adults who live with ADHD, many of which are probably undiagnosed, actually, quite frankly, and the implications on addictive behavior, alcoholism, self-medicating behavior, as well as depression, traumatic relationships, etc. What do we know about how lifestyle interventions can help ameliorate those? I mean, the first thing is recognizing it, I guess.
Yeah. This is arguably the topic of my next book, because it's a really, really under-researched area. And that is the fact that oftentimes children with ADHD are educationally failed, and then they face permanent exclusion, and then they're placed potentially in what's called a pupil referral unit. And within pupil referral units, it increases risks towards the gravitation of a delinquent peer group, criminal gang related activity. And we now know through the work of Professor Susan Young that over 30% of all incarcerated adults have undiagnosed ADHD. So for example, the symptoms weren't correctly identified or diagnosed in childhood. And because of that impulsive self-medicating aspect of ADHD with educational failure, you know, and also I noticed it in my own son, you know, his self-esteem was stripped away because every single day he was told off. Imagine that. You know, if you think about a child with a physical disability in a wheelchair, you wouldn't be saying stand up and walk. Yeah. But with a child with an invisible mental health condition, they are constantly told, you know, sit still or shut up or stop moving or stop that or don't do that or you're this, you're that. And that's what they're exposed to. And it creates all sorts of problems. And so, yeah, so in terms of risk factors in our adult ADHD community, they are overrepresented in the prison system. And it's a real shame, because it's like, which way is the pendulum going to swing? Because often these subtle differences in the wiring of the brain give rise to such creativity and, you know, gifts in a, for want of a better word, you know, the ability to hyperfocus, which is like the ability to shut out the outside world and focus intently and creatively on a project. You know, there are people that are known to us, like Sir Richard Branson, who has dyslexia and a bit of ADD style symptoms, and, you know, Steven Spielberg, who's completely dyslexic. And, you know, there are so many people out there who are role models, you know, Olympian gold medalists and entertainers and writers and actors and so on. You know, the list is endless of gifts that ADHD can bring. But the other side is the dark side of ADHD, which is not really spoken about. It's not really discussed, you know, and much more investment needs to go into this, because the criminologist Adrian Raine, I don't know if you know, have you heard, he wrote this book, I think it's called The Brain Anatomy of Violence or something like that. Yeah, he's a criminologist, and he was kind of the first person to show structural differences in the brains of incarcerated adults who are, for example, on death row. And he brought up that whole kind of notion of philosophical concept of free will, because there were such differences in the way the brain had developed, arguably as a result of, you know, abuse and trauma in childhood and, you know, nutritional deprivation and all sorts of things, all sorts of contributing factors that had given rise to his notion of the criminal brain. And Adrian Raine decided to do a 6-month clinical trial supplementing children in the community with omega-3 and I believe a multivitamin. And what he found was significant reductions in something called the inventory of callous and unemotional traits, which was developed by Paul Frick. And it's an indicator, a sizable indicator for the risk of the development of pathology in children. So psychopathology in terms of conduct disorder, antisocial personality disorder, all of which can, you know, lead you very quickly to prison, basically. So I think what he found, sorry, just to go back to his clinical trial, what he found was, I think it was like something like, I can't remember the exact figures, so excuse me, but it was like 58% reduction in these ICU traits in children, as well as overall improvements in their behavior. So, and I, at my research at the Institute of Psychiatry, I also measured callous and unemotional traits in my cohort of children who had ADHD and comorbid conduct disorder. And what I found was that the lower the omega-3, the higher the callous and unemotional traits. So I found significant positive correlations. And, there were relationships between higher ICU traits and lower DHA and EPA and total omega-3 as well. And then Adrian Raine's research was really exciting for me because it's like, hey, I found these kind of correlations. And of course, you know, correlations are just associations, that's all. But then he went a step further and actually supplemented them within a clinical trial context over a 6-month period and found reductions in their callous and unemotional traits. So there are potential things we can do, is like identify risk factors, make potential, you know, nutritional changes, you know, maybe something like mentoring as well, assigning a mentor to a child who's at risk of educational failure. Because if you can keep a child within education, you're going to significantly reduce their risk of developing a condition like conduct disorder or ending up in criminality. Because, you know, young people with ADHD are highly impulsive. You know, it's almost like this kind of continuous conflict, which happens in teenagers anyway, between the limbic system, which is the kind of oldest, more primitive part of the brain, which I refer to as the accelerator. So it's the part of the brain that's like, kind of like, you know, do this, wouldn't that be exciting? Or, you know, sort of sensation, thrill seeking, novelty seeking, like, you know, behaviors.
Yeah.
Versus the frontal cortex, which is the last part of the brain to develop. It normally doesn't finish developing in a young adult till around the age of 23, which we've discovered through neuroimaging research. So during adolescence, you have this cognitive conflict between the limbic system and the frontal cortex going on, or the accelerator and the brakes, because of course the frontal cortex is the part of the brain that says, hey, wait, let's think about this. Yeah. You know, is this a good decision or not? Yeah. And but if you've got this, like, you know, very active limbic system, and in ADHD, imagine it's even worse, because the frontal cortex is impaired, you know, like often the activity is, you know, not functioning as it should. So that can increase risk of all sorts of things, like, you know, engaging in illegal substances or acting impulsively or getting into fights or teenage pregnancy, which we know all of this can happen anyway. So I think it's a really important area to look at risk factors. What can we do to, in terms of preventative research? Because prevention is key.
Yeah.
And I think something like less than 2% of all research funds are allocated to preventative research here in the UK. And that's shocking, because there's so much we can do in terms of, because no one wants their kid who's already got a neurodevelopmental difference to end up in jail when they could be the next Sir Richard Branson.
Exactly.
I mean, it's literally that, you know?
It's literally that. It reminds you of that talk that Sir Ken Robinson gave at TED.
I
must have watched it like 20 times.
Squashing and, creativity in mainstream schools.
Honestly. And it's just like, you know, this child, because she had a chance interaction with a psychiatrist who recognized her innate talent, you know, was prevented from a life of being scolded, medicated, and not allowed to reach her full potential. So, you know, it's an incredible crossroads that so many children are experiencing to this day. And, you know, the knowledge that nutrition and targeted supplementation can potentially help, along with the suite of other interventions like, you know, mentorship, I think is brilliant. Psychotherapy, again, community. These are all things that I think are super important. And it's fascinating. Are there any other supplements other than omega-3 that you think are worth an honorable mention with regards to ADHD and nutrition strategies.
Yes, I recommend that parents seek the help of a nutritionist or a dietitian, go and get a blood test and look at particular nutrients which we know play a role in our brains and our brain's function. And if those nutrients are lacking, then you would want to supplement. But there are a range of nutrients, especially the B vitamins, you know, as I said, zinc, magnesium. There's been some research on these that have shown to be potentially beneficial to children with ADHD. So yeah, but if we don't look, we're sort of like testing, or we're supplementing when there's no need to supplement necessarily, or, you know, so you do need to look at the blood, look at the data.
Yeah, we need to be informed, I think, about all these things. So I think a lot of people are just swimming in the dark with regards to particularly supplementation. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's something that I've had experience of. And a lot of people ask me, you know, can you actually achieve adequate levels with diet alone? I'd like to think we can, but I think in certain instances, I mean, I take a vitamin D3, omega-3 and a B complex myself.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, now there's increasing research saying vitamin D is protective of respiratory conditions, certain respiratory conditions, or protective or beneficial or both. I'm not quite sure of the latest research, but there's suggestions of that, and especially with COVID around, like we want to build up our immune system and keep ourselves as healthy as possible. I'm not opposed to supplements. I always say change the diet first. That's always like the nutrients are in the food and they work synergistically. So, you know, if you're juicing, for example, like using a NutriBullet or something like that, all the fibers retained, you know, whereas if you're just getting a carton of juice, you know, and it's made from concentrate, you're not getting all those vitamins and antioxidants that boost your brain. So yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Honestly, I really enjoyed it.
Brilliant. I really hope you enjoyed that podcast with Dr. Rachel. She is fantastic. I really enjoy the fact that she has both a non-profit and a consulting organization as well. If you do want to check those out, it is nutritiousminds.org. I can't wait for her book to come out in February 2021. I know that's going to be groundbreaking, and I know it's going to help a number of people, particularly given how rife ADHD is in this country and beyond. Please do leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And do check out the newsletter that we launch every week, thedoctorskitchen.com. Do check it out, and I will see you here next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.